for Asian religious priesthood, whether it's Hinduism or Buddhism, when they encounter a Western individual who's having a religious experience, to them, it's an impossibility for a Westerner to have a religious experience because we are demons, according to them. We are the asuras.
And that's why usually the Asian Buddhist communities don't integrate with the culture. So I noticed that Buddhist communities, when they go into other Asian countries, they tend to pick up cultural aspects of that particular country. But when they come here, it seems that they're kind of separatists from the Western culture. Well, it's just an observation I've made about Buddhism.
Well, that's very true. You know, there's basically three basic vehicles of Buddhism. It's Theravadan Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, and Tibetan Buddhism, which is known as Vajrayana. And they are three distinct forms of Buddhism. Mahayana Buddhism is primarily Chinese, Vajrayana is Tibetan, and Theravadan Buddhism is Southern Asian. But your observation is a little bit incorrect. The reason why Buddhism was expressed in three basic different ways in Asia is because, you know, Buddhism's been there for 1,500 years,
right,
and they've had an opportunity to articulate Buddhism for themselves and distance themselves from the earlier forms of Buddhism and create their own form of Buddhism. Whereas Buddhism arrived in the West really only about 150 years ago,
right,
and it's been growing very slowly, and now all of a sudden in the last 30 years, Buddhism is growing rapidly in the West. But it's still growing as an Asian import, not really as a native religion. And in part, the effort of the Great Western Vehicle is for the Western people to articulate Buddhism within their own context. And that's why we're looking to Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross and the Christian mystics, because we want to that, because that's the history of European religious movements, and we want to blend European religious movements into Buddhism, because otherwise we don't see how we're going to come up with a Western Buddhism if we don't do that.
Right. And one final question. To gain these ecstatic experiences you're talking about, jhana, approximately how long does a meditator have to meditate in order to begin to acquire these experiences?
Do you know, when I lead a class, a meditation class, and let's say it's a weekly meditation class, and we might meditate for a half hour to an hour, most of the people in that class experience jhana, or these ecstatic states. They begin to experience those within the second or third session of the class. So the second, third, or fourth time we meet, almost everybody's experiencing jhana. So people can experience it very quickly. The difference is that we create a context or a set and setting that is conducive to the experience of these ecstatic states. Whereas if you look at the more traditional forms of Buddhism, you'll hear the meditation teachers being negative about the ecstatic states. And they call, they call us bliss bunnies. Oh, you don't want to be a bliss bunny, do you? You know, they'll say to their followers.
What's the term again? Bliss
bunny.
Bliss bunny, okay.
Right, we're called bliss bunnies.
I've never heard that term before.
Yeah, the Zen people call the ecstatic Buddhists bliss bunnies.
Oh, how nice.
Right, right. And so our community of ecstatic Buddhists are made up of people who have studied Stoic forms of Buddhism, right, who've gone to their meditation teacher and said, I'm having this experience in meditation. And the meditation teacher says, oh, just ignore all that, right? Well, we don't invalidate people. Instead, we validate people. And we go, excellent, you're experiencing bliss, joy, and ecstasy. That's precisely how the Buddha defined the Eightfold or the Noble Eightfold Path, which he did.
This is is very interesting. I actually learned some stuff that I didn't know. I mean, I've corresponded with you before and stuff, but it's sad that other groups have to marginalize or actually use labels to define something that's different from them. But is there anything else you wanted to say before I wrap up here?
No, it's just that Bliss, Joy, and Ecstasy, I know, is available to anybody who engages in a contemplative life in a skillful way. And part of being skillful about the practice of leading a contemplative life is engaging in it every day, not just on Sunday or on holy days, but engaging in a contemplative life every day. And engaging in that contemplative life specifically to produce bliss, joy, and ecstasy.
Interesting, Jeff. Thank you for your information there.